The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello and welcome to Century of Lies. Century of Lies is a production of the Drug Truth Network for the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network on the web at drugtruth.net. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of drugwarfacts.org. Welcome to part two of our Seattle HempFest 2017 special coverage. The Rick Smith Hempodium is the southernmost stage at HempFest. That's where they have panel discussions. It's a circus tent that is site of a number of great keynote speeches, and also panels. I was on one this year called Cannabis and Media Beyond Stereotypes. We're going to give a listen to that panel. The speakers you're about to hear in order are Susan Squibb, Wes Abney, Ophelia Chong, Russ Belleville, and yours truly. And the panel was moderated by Chris Conrad.
So my moniker is Cannabis Maven, and that's a moniker I adopted in 2012. And so when I started freelance writing, and so most consistently I've been the marijuana advice columnist for the Cannabist, it's Ask the Cannabist. But I've also done product reviews and event coverage, and one of the most exciting highlights in my career is writing for the 2014, covering the first sale in Colorado. I was a few feet away from the first media sale, so that was pretty exhilarating. But in terms of the cannabis and media and the stereotypes, I mean, there is the historical stereotypes of, you know, the beginning, you know, Reefer Madness that Chris had mentioned. And how that, you know, the consumers are kind of demonized, and the black jazz musicians, and, you know, the migrant workers from Mexico and Central America, and then you know, and the reefer madness of that, and the persecution of you know, marijuana laws and people. But then in the 60s, with the hippie movement, then it became a much more of a lenient time, relatively speaking, and that there was a lot more acceptance. And so you have laws changing, decriminalization and possession lessening to more misdemeanors rather than felonies. But, you know, then the 80s is another period of time where things get pretty harsh. But in terms of, like, coverage and the stereotypes in the media, you know, I think that there's a long precedence of the cannabis culture and covering the culture and having a really sympathetic or supportive, you know, wanting to tell the side and the facts and the experience of people that are working on the reform, and also just the you know, it's like Jack Herrera, the Emperor Wears No Clothes, the benefits of the plant, whether it's for, you know, the industrial use and medical use. But, you know, I think that the really challenge for the media is, as we are broadening and you have more mainstream outlets that are working on cannabis coverage, that, you know, with the journalism, there's that separation of the editorial side from the marketing side. And I think that when you have a smaller outlet and they're combining those two, then it becomes sort of challenging to really do those investigative stories with a critical eye towards the industry, because you're also getting your money and funding from the companies. But it's also a really crucial aspect of sort of marijuana media is to have those smaller local magazines and outlets that are covering the stories, you know, and the issues on the local area, you know, really like the community standards of what does the medical program, you know, the patients, what the patient needs are. And then as the marijuana, the social use and those issues get tackled, like, what is the community standards for, you know, for the local area? You know, what is something? Is it dab bars? Is it smoke-free? Is it just vaporizers? I mean, these are all the issues that that are important that journalists can point to and show what the options are. And it's a great way to capture what we are grappling with and the changes, and how that we run through the sort of the threads of society and pinpoint and capture that, and so people can see. And telling compelling stories of individuals is a really great way to do that. there's a social justice issues that I think that is really important for maintaining in for journalists. Oh, there you are, Chris. yeah, and that's like, I think that's a good wrap up of a few of my thoughts.
Hi, my name is Wes Abney. I founded Northwest Leaf magazine here in Washington back in 2010. I don't know if any of you have seen that. And, you know, back at that time for me, cannabis was becoming a medicine and something I saw as a social justice issue. And I was studying journalism and working on a paper in college and started a community newspaper with two friends, just with the idea kind of what Susan mentioned is of being at the local voice. And we called ourselves the patient voice, the patient's voice. Fast forward 7 years later, we've printed over 3 million copies between three states, currently in Oregon and Alaska as well, and really working hard to produce the best quality content that's focused for patients, that's focused for consumers and business owners in an enlightening format that's positive for the industry. And for me personally, I have so much faith in the power of cannabis and what it can do for our country and how it can change people's lives. And so we've tried to break through stereotypes by showing voices and showing stories and the real proof of what this plant can do. And it's been my great honor to share people's stories, and to be able to provide that in print has been great in this day and age. Anything in print is very difficult. And so it's really fun, and I'm thankful for the industry and, you know, the plant and everything we have.
Hi, I'm Ophelia Chong. I'm a and I can drive. And I can't do math. I failed in algebra. Yes, hey, I had to take summer school. I was the only Chinese person in my high school class who had to take math again, and it was very disappointing. So what I do is I have two things. I have stockpot images that I started because of the stereotype of, quote unquote, the stoner, right? If I went to January 2015, I went to Getty Images, I looked up cannabis, pot, and what came up were images of what you would call the stoner stereotype. And the key wording on that was illegal, addict, drugs, arrested. So all the keywords that this major company, billion-dollar company, Getty Images, were using was perpetuating that stereotype. So 4 months later, I launched Stockpot Images, and now we're at over 20,000 images of real users from Seed to Sale, the largest collection of strains, and of over 200 photographers from around the world. Plus, I pay the largest commission ever in our business, 50%. Plus, we're partnered with Adobe. So that's how, for me, moving beyond a stereotype. And also, I run Asian Americans for Cannabis Education. I feature an Asian American who wants to come out and talk about using it on my website. And I just keep pushing that forward, that yes, we can drive, and we can smoke weed. And we grow a lot of it, too. So that's my journey.
My name is Russ Belville. I'm the host of The Marijuana Agenda, which is a live daily talk radio podcast by, for, and about the cannabis community. You can find it at mjagenda.com. I record that podcast every day live at Delta 9 House and Studios, where we have a cannabis-friendly Airbnb, people coming in from all over the world. And it's interesting dispelling some of the stereotypes they have when they show up. We've had guests from Finland and Germany and Austria and all these other places. And it's fun to get to show them what's going on in Oregon, get to show them a legal cannabis garden. And I think sometimes just living our honest life is one of the best ways of breaking those stereotypes. You know, just being upfront about our usage, and that we work, and that we're parents, and that we do all these other things that everybody else does. So I'm happy to be able to do that as a professional life. And I also want to just make sure that we mention that Seattle Hemp Fest has been doing this for 26 years and breaking these stereotypes where the city of Seattle and the general public think, oh, the stoners, they can't get stuff done, they're all lazy, they're unmotivated. This takes some motivation. This takes a lot of organization. Let's give it up for Hemp Fest, first of all.
And donate.
And second of all, if you haven't donated to Hemp Fest yet, you don't have to, but if you don't, terrible, terrible things will happen to you. Karma's weird that way. But I did want to make a mention of when we're talking about the media, one of the things that's happening lately, just on a general perspective, is this concept of fake news. Hashtag fake news, right? And I think it's funny, and maybe Doug will share this perspective. It's funny to see everybody outraged about fake news when we in the cannabis media have been dealing with fake news for about 80 years now. Fake news started in 1930s with Harry J. Anslinger saying it would the marijuana would cause the white women to have sex with the black people, and oh my God, the jazz musicians. So we've been dealing with fake news for a long time. I just kind of chuckle when people now talk about fake news, but we do have to guard against fake news in our own media. I mean, I see stories all the time about CBD oil being legal in all 50 states. It should be. It's not. But it should be. But it ain't. DEA will tell you it ain't legal. We see stories, just one that came up recently. We just passed a bill in Oregon that defelonized all personal drug possession. And I saw some stories in the cannabis meeting saying Oregon's decriminalized all drugs. No, they're still criminal if you got meth or coke or heroin, but you just don't get a felony for it anymore. It's down to a misdemeanor. So we have to guard against fake news on our side as well. So that's my perspective on the media and the stereotypes, and we'll look forward to more questions and discussion.
You know, you don't get to choose how you get stereotyped. You just don't. And it's a lot older than that. I mean, the classic stereotype image, right? It's lazy, stupid, disrespectful. These are racist stereotypes. It's rooted in racism. It's not stated out loud, but it is coded. It's not just a way of mockery. It's also a very unsubtle message that if you people, you smoke pot. See, if you smoke pot, we're going to start, we, the public, the society, you know, the powers that be, we're going to start thinking of you just like we think of the blacks and the Latinos. And you know what? We might even start treating you like we treat the blacks and the Latinos. That's the threat. That's the code. It's coded. See, that's... We understand now this whole dog whistle politics. We don't necessarily hear people coming out to say exactly what they mean. They talk in code. So that was the warning in all that. Now, we've worked pretty well at getting rid of that stereotype, and it's because of people like Mickey Norris and the Cannabis Consumers Campaign, frankly, that we've been able to really dispel that. We could always say it's not true. Of course it's not true. It's never been true. We knew that stereotype wasn't true. We knew it because we're all pot smokers, and that's not us. But until the microphone went, there we go. But until we started, I'll try not to get loud, I promise. It's tough because this is a heavy thing. But until we started coming out of the closet and saying that we are not that stereotype, then, well, people are just going to believe what they believe. And, you see, it's not a question of convincing the prohibitionists that they're wrong, because we're not going to convince you. You can talk to a refrigerator all that you want. You know, the light comes on, the light comes off, and the door opens and shuts. It's not going to listen to you. But the public who is watching that debate, who's listening to that debate, that's who they're trying to convince. So maybe we need to think about convincing that general public too. So by coming out of the closet and showing people that I'm a pot smoker, I'm an active, motivated individual who gets stuff done, that stereotype is a lie. That's how that stuff happens. Coming out of the closet did that. Now there's another stereotype that's going around, and this is huge. People like Kevin Sabet and others are pushing this image that, you see, they used to say, we just want legalization so you can get high. Well, obviously not. Like I say, came out of the closet and proved that. Now they're saying another thing. You just want legalization so you can make a greasy buck. You know, they're talking about us becoming the new big tobacco, big marijuana is going to be. And, you know, we play right into that when we talk about all the money and look at all the money. You're going to make so much money from this. And wow, check all this money. We're playing into that, you see. Now, I didn't get into this to make a greasy buck. I've walked away from some perfectly good and quite lucrative jobs because the politics were just like, I wasn't going to stay there anymore, or personal abuses from the bosses or some other kinds of stuff. I'm a nonprofit journalist. I scrape by, and it's just because I have a conscience. But you see, that's the point. I need to speak out and talk about that, and so do the rest of us. And it's not just about our personal situation. It's why we do this. You didn't do this so you could get high. You didn't start working on legalization. I sure didn't, because I thought it was going to make me $1 million.
We're doing this because it's the right thing to do, because it's a smart thing to do, because it's what good policy should be. It's about social justice. I came out of the social justice movement. So do a lot of the other people doing this. And the people involved in HempFest, a lot of them are involved in social justice outside of marijuana politics. True of a lot of the activist friends we've got, the people who are really pushing this thing forward. We're coming out of social justice, and that's the reality. And that's the truth we have to start speaking, and we have to come out of the closet as social justice progressive activists. To move beyond the stereotypes, we have to let people know why we're doing this and speak loudly about it. When Betty Aldworth talked about the hashtag Just Say No to Hate, Roger Stone is not an anti-drug. He's pushing marijuana. Why are you complaining? Because he's an evil, nasty man. He is pushing hatred and spewing violent rhetoric and encouraging violence, just like our current president. And that goes way beyond just a question of legalization. This is about where we're from. This is about social justice. Some things are wrong. And we started this stuff because there are things that are wrong, and we know we have to pledge our lives and our sacred honor and our fortunes to make a change. So if we can't just speak out and say that our president was a jerk, that Charlottesville was the fault of the neo-Nazis and the KKK and their frickin' sympathizers, and that racism and violence has no place in a decent society, and that we as a marijuana movement, as a drug policy reform movement, will have nothing to do with mean, nasty, evil, violent, hate-spewing. Sorry, I was trying to be all clean. So, yeah, that's the stereotype I think we need to do. We need to be more upfront about who we are.
You're listening to Century of Lies, a production of the Drug Truth Network for the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. This is part two of our Seattle HempFest 2017 special coverage. We're listening to a panel from the Hemposium stage on cannabis and media beyond stereotypes. Appearing along with me were Susan Squibb, Ophelia Chong, Wes Abney, and Russ Belleville. After we gave our opening statements, we started taking questions from the moderator and the panel. The moderator of that panel, by the way, was Chris Conrad.
Thank you. Thank you to the panel here. Give them a big round of applause. And people who have questions, we are willing to give that to them. One of the things I would like to raise as a question, though, is because Mickey and I were the publishers of the West Coast Leaf, and before that I was a publisher and editor of the Oaksterdam News, two marijuana newspapers that were covered the scene for everybody for a while. Now we've seen the way that's been absorbed into the internet, and we've seen a lot of cannabis magazines. They seem to come and go. High Times is sticking around, but a lot of them seem to go pretty quickly, actually, over time. And so, and then you were just talking about the social media stuff, Russ, and how that's actually been used by our adversaries disguised as our friends in order. I think that's where the fake news comes in. When they say you're their friend as they're stabbing you in the back, that's fake news. If they say you're an enemy and they stab you in the back, you expect it. But in any case, what about the changes in the media moving forward from here? Is it still a matter of make a postcard and hand it out or try to start a magazine? Or are we still looking at blogs? Or why don't we talk a little bit about the future of how we changed our images?
Yeah, I think definitely we're more in a online world now than print media. There are a lot of magazines, and there's a place for that. But I think things are changing so fast and in so many states that the news. I do it, like I said, do a live daily news show on cannabis, and it used to be a struggle trying to find how am I going to fill the whole time. Now I'm having to cut stories because there's so much going on everywhere, and I don't think The magazines and newspapers are great archivally, have archives of what's happened, but for breaking news and as fast as it's changing, you've got to be online. You've got to be following people on social media. There's times I wish I didn't have to. Times it's overwhelming, but you've got to find the social media feeds. All the major organizations have them, like Marijuana Policy Project, Normal, Americans for Safe Access, Law Enforcement Action Partnership, Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies. There's a million of them, and they'll give you what's coming through that Twitter feed will oftentimes be links to stories that you can then go click on and read on the internet and get more information. So I know not everybody's online, or they think, what am I going to do with this Twitter thing? What good is it? For me, it reminds me of, like, back in the 60s, they'd say, we have this coming in from The Wire. Well, it's the wire. That's all it is. Twitter's just this wire of information coming to you. And if you follow the right organizations and the right people, you'll get a ton of great information. And it's especially useful for the activist base out there that wants to promote media, because they don't necessarily have newspapers or people working at the newspapers to do columns or anything like that. But they do have a social media account. They do have a Facebook presence. They do have a website or a blog or a Tumblr or an Instagram or something that's going to get out to the people. And it can be localized. It can be very specific to what we're doing, and people can follow that and get a lot of benefit from it. So can't underestimate what we can use in the online world here.
I'm going to talk about this then. This is a Seattle-produced magazine, Push. It's by all women. And how it started was Abigail Ross, who's a friend of mine, and a few other women at Dope were all pushed out. They were either told to leave or fired. And so what we started was Push Mag. We were pushed. And so we feature women. It's made by women, and it's based in Seattle. So if you want to come and look at this after, it is how we are, it's a millennial magazine. It's mostly focused on women from about 21 up to 35. But we feature Asian American artists, African American artists, and all women. And it's here.
Where can you get it?
Yeah. You can get it online at pushmag.com for $20 an issue, or you can support us for $60 a year and get 4 issues mailed to you. Yeah. Produced by the women who were kicked out of Dope for being women. Sorry.
And you know, I'd like to say too on the value of print media in our society has definitely shifted over the last decade with the influx of social media and the influx of just, you know, the wide availability of internet. But especially in this new era of fake news, print is becoming inherently valuable because in part of the hard costs that it takes to produce it. Anyone can post a blog post, but when true publications like, say, the Seattle Times, large influential publications, decide to start tackling things, or Time, or any of these other publications that are out there. I don't think Time's in print anymore. No. You know, when print media is used properly, it has a huge influence. And in the cannabis industry, you know, I can't tell you the benefit of getting to have the legacy and the look back on what has happened. And when we get to share stories with people, it's really something special to hold it. You know, you actually hold a story or you hold a Push magazine and you feel that connection. And, you know, for us, at least with my publications, our big goal is shifting into the internet and shifting into, we've used social media for years to share stories and gain wider followership. But at the heart of it is something that you can pick up and hold, and that, you know, we distribute all over in the states that we are in. And in Alaska, we are everywhere from the bush to Anchorage. And I can't tell you the phone calls and the emails we get from people who don't have internet access, who have never gotten the truth about cannabis. And we're reaching them in a community format that they trust and they relate to. And it's truly powerful. And I think that, you know, we can't overlook the power of print in cannabis when it's done right, or in this world. You know, we have to demand accountability for journalism. We have to demand accountability for the content that's being put out there. And print is a way to hold it's inherently accountable on a certain level just because of what it takes to make it happen. And so I think that it's a beautiful thing, and I think it's great for our country to encourage journalism on every level and make sure that we're spreading, you know, real truth.
I'd like to add, in, for the shift in the coverage, so for the print, it's not the best venue for more of the political, which is like such a timely, fast-paced beat to cover. But I think that the print has a really great format in, you know, really bringing together the community and sharing the stories in the community, and also supporting it with the event coverage, you know, either before the events or, you know, as a way to document what's happening, you know, at the events and such. But it is a challenge for journalists to adapt to that, you know, the format between print and the digital piece. Yeah.
Got something there, Doug? You look like
I got nothing. I do radio. I mean, you know, the last time we published an edition of Drug War Facts was in 2007. What's really weird, I still have people come up and say that, and tell me that they've got the thing on their shelves, which is, I mean, thank you. It's 10 years old. It's online. It's, believe me, it's been updated. It's grown. It's expanded. The main reason we don't publish right now is paper costs, printing costs. It's a huge database now, and paring it down to actually fit within a budget.
Yeah, now, so then, let's talk about the radio for a second then, because first off, there's the online radio, then there's your local radio stations, and like, I remember during the Prop 64 campaign, I was on this radio station in Fresno, not the most friendly area, and so one of the things that the host says to me is, so you're not just saying this is for medical use, right, because people just want to get high. I said, yeah, this is about people getting high. It was really nice to be able to embrace that, and so forth. I'm not sure 100% how it went over in Fresno, but you know, it went over well with the show and so forth. So then, I just like to talk a little bit about that idea, though. If you're working a regional radio program, do you do a lot of homework on that about who your audience is, or do you just blast away with your standard operating things that work every place, or what? How do you deal with the radio audience as opposed to these other audiences like the print audience or the online audience?
There's a two levels. I mean, I work in news and public affairs at KBOO Radio. It's a volunteer thing. I produce a program. I produce the Monday evening newscast. Monday's going to be such a great day, it's all volunteer. And I found a place at KBOO where I fit in. I'm very much a left wing progressive social justice activist. I'm an aggressive progressive. I'm an American patriot. And these are things. It's not a contradiction, weirdly enough. And you know, it fits in. It's good. We have a show about criminal justice system called Prison Pipeline. I work with them. I've interviewed some amazing people who Kirk Bloodsworth, who was the first person in the United States to have spent time on death row, sentenced for a heinous murder that he never committed, but DNA evidence proved him innocent. DNA evidence found the right person, and I'm using that word wrongly, to finally put away. It was brilliant, but you know, he lost a decade of his life in a hellhole. So, it's fascinating stuff. There's also a thing I do that's syndicated called Century of Lies. That's over the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network. My friend Dean Becker down in Houston developed that show, and it continues. I mean, you can tell if you're doing well if people pick up your show and keep carrying it, and if they don't, well, I guess you messed up, or maybe it just wasn't right. It isn't easy. I talk at the end of my show. I always refer to people as dear listener. I was in my shows. I always say, thanks to you, dear listener, because you make it all worth it. And I'll tell you a secret. Dear listener is a 55-year-old, she's going to kill me for saying that, woman who, with a master's degree and who's just a beautiful, wonderful person and very progressive and intelligent. And if she likes the show, it worked. My audience is one. And so far, it's been successful.
All right, that was a panel on cannabis and media beyond stereotypes that was held at the Rick Smith Hemposium at Seattle Hempfest just last weekend. Appearing along with me were Susan Squibb, Ophelia Chong, Wes Abney, and Russ Belleville. The panel was moderated by the activist and noted hemp expert Chris Conrad. We'll have more from Seattle Hempfest in our next show. For now, that's all the time we have. Thank you for joining us. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. You've been listening to Century of Lies, a production of the Drug Truth Network for the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network, on the web at drugtruth.net. The executive producer of the Drug Truth Network is Dean Becker. Drug Truth Network programming is available via podcast. Check the homepage for the URLs to subscribe. Drug Truth Network is on Facebook. Please give its page a like. Drug War Facts is on Facebook, too. Give its page a like and share it with friends. Remember, knowledge is power. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Doug McVeigh, and of course, also at Drug Policy Facts. We'll be back next week with 30 minutes of news and information on the drug war and this century of lies. For now, for the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long.
So long!
For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the century of lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.